the mic.
Good morning, everyone. I'm opening the February 8th meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. And this morning, we're going to have public hearings on two bills. The first bill is House Bill 2152. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing. We're going to hear both of the bills and take any testimony that folks have to offer. This morning, we have Representative David Gomberg, whom is going to help us with an overview of the bill after, I believe, we have the committee administrator, Mr. Crawford, describe the bill for us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2152 allows small business development centers to use state grant funding for outreach and marketing. Requires the Oregon Business Development Department to collaborate with other state agencies, state-supported organizations, and private sector entities to provide specified services to small businesses.
Good morning, Representative Gomberg. Please introduce yourself for the record, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the beautiful Oregon coast. And I'm pleased to be here today on 2152, a bill that was brought forward by the Interim Special Committee on Small Business Growth. So, Madam Chair, colleagues, if you could imagine for a moment what would happen if a company decided to relocate here to Oregon and create 500 new jobs. What would the headlines look like? Big company comes to Oregon, produces 500 new jobs. Now imagine if that company had 19 satellite offices and those 500 jobs were spread throughout the entire state, in every corner of the state, impacting every economy and every community throughout all of Oregon. You know, that's basically what the Small Business Development Center Network does. But they do that by empowering small businesses and creating about 500 new jobs a year. They do that by helping people who have ideas, who have concepts, who have ambitions, and to turn those into real opportunities. You know about, you want to start a restaurant, you know about baking, but you don't know about human resources. You don't know about social media. You don't know how to run QuickBooks. And you go to your Small Business Development Center, and they teach you those skills so you can turn your concept, your idea, your ambitions into a real business and for real jobs for the people that will work for you. Again, creating about 500 new jobs a year across the state of Oregon. Now, here's the catch. Small business development centers aren't allowed to talk about themselves. They're not allowed to market themselves. In our committee over the interim, they were described as one of the best-kept secrets in Oregon. And one of our colleagues leaned over to me during the hearings and said, you can't sell a secret. And that's where the impetus for this bill came from. It allows SBDCs to use not our money, but grant money to market themselves and to reach out to even more businesses and continue the success story that they are generating across the state. Now, I had hoped that the director of the Small Business Development Network was going to be here. I'm not sure where he is to talk in a little more detail about many of the things they're accomplishing and of some of the impediments that are in their way to accomplishing even more. But I think I've given you a sense of what these folks do. The 19 centers are connected with our community colleges across the state. And so if you've got a small business looking for help, send them to the community college. They'll link them up with the Small Business Development Network, and they'll make good things happen. But at this point, it is all passive, and we're trying to create a system that's a little more active so that these networks, these business centers, can reach out and promote just a little more effectively what they do and help draw more people into this successful program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's great. We've got a question from Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gomberg. My question would be, so the outreach efforts are going to cost some dollars. How is that going to impact their limited funding now in regards to assisting business?
Madam Chair, Representative Brocksmith, excellent question. Some of us think that we should be getting more money to our SBDC network so they can do more good work. And you can, of course, gauge what the likelihood of that will be during this daunting session. But that being said, yes, they're going to be drawing on grant dollars. That will spread their resources thin. This doesn't obligate them to advertise. It simply gives them the option going forward to do more marketing.
Any other questions for Representative Gomberg? Thank you very much for being here today. It looks like we have one individual signed up to provide testimony, Tammy Marquez Oldham from the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network. So if you could please come forward, we'd love to hear from you. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, good morning. Chair Linkender and members of the committee, my name is Tammy Marquez Oldham. I'm the director of the Portland Community College Small Business Development Center, and I'm here today to give testimony. Mark Gregory, the executive director of the SBDC network, sends his apologies. He's in Washington, D.C. with the delegation there. I'll try to be brief on my testimony here today, as I know this committee has other topics on the agenda. House Bill 2152 comes to you from the House Special Committee on Small Business Growth. I know that many of you served on this committee, and you have already heard some of the background from Representative Gomberg. Thank you. This bill has two parts, a marketing authorization component and a component that encourages state agencies to work with the small business development centers. I'll address the first. The marketing piece in Section 1. In my position as the director of the Small Business Development Center at Portland Community College, it is not unusual for me to hear, and I have a front row seat on, the response from small business owners who say, I'm so glad I found you, but you are a hidden secret. You're a hidden treasure. I think that this bill would help address this issue. SBDCs are federally funded through the Small Business Administration and receive matching funds from the state to provide our essential services to small businesses across Oregon. This federal money and the state match comes with specific restrictions about how these funds can be used for marketing under the federal rules, which our funding is authorized. We can use federal money to market the specific program paid for with SBA and state matching funds, but the rules don't allow for us to market our services broadly. For example, we could not place an ad in the Portland Business Journal encouraging business owners and entrepreneurs to come to an open house event where they could learn about our services. We also couldn't use federal money to pay for such an event. The same is true for billboards, podcasts, social media ads that may be very effective in helping us reach more people, more small business owners. This bill helps Oregon SBDCs by allowing funds that aren't used in part of the federal match to be used for marketing, which helps us again to reach more small businesses who are creating jobs. House Bill 2152 does not allocate additional funding to the SBDCs, and we don't anticipate that it will have a fiscal impact. It simply allows us to use additional funds, if allocated by the legislator, to reach more potential clients, small businesses. The second section is Section 3 of the bill, and this is about collaboration. This helps codify into law some of the existing best practices that we already implement, working with other state agencies. We're working with Representative Gomberg to offer an amendment to clarify the intent of this section. With the Dash 1 amendments, we're ensuring that this section will not have any additional impact on Business Oregon, as these activities will be conducted through the Oregon SBDC network in coordination with other parties as appropriate. We already do excellent work with the Secretary of State and the Bureau of Labor and Industries on business regulation. We also have an active program with the Oregon Department of Transportation to help small businesses with contracting. Our SBDCs across the state are already working with many of the small businesses that our other state agencies need to communicate with. We want to make it easier for small businesses to access training opportunities that help them succeed and comply with regulations. Small business owners and entrepreneurs are busy, and reducing the number of stops by combining training and outreach can save everyone time, energy, and resources. Section 3 helps establish this legislative intent that we will work together through the SBDCs to make small business into Oregon's best businesses. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Wonderful, thank you. Yeah. We've got a question for Representative Olson, and
thanks,
then
Mayor, and Representative Gomberg, you might jump in here. I don't get this. I mean, why is there a fence or a prevention from small business being able to do what this bill seeking to do?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, just to clarify your question, is the question what is the barrier preventing small business development centers to do the thing that we're asking to
right.
be done? As stated in the testimony, the federal contract under SBA is very specific about how the use of funds can be deployed within our scope of services. And so it is believed that this particular House bill will help us to be able to use funds in a way to no longer be a hidden resource for those who need us the most.
Okay. Representative Reschke.
Yes. So I've heard two, and again, Representative Gomberg, and thank you for coming, Ms. Marquez Oldham. I'm a little confused. I heard there is no state money, but then there's a state match. Can you clarify how that works?
So part of the, Madam Chair, Representative, part of the requirements for federal funding is to have a state match. That is something that is part of our core funding and therefore would not be additional funding.
So follow-up.
Yes, please.
So that there's no additional funds, it's just you're reallocating how that match is.
That is correct, to my knowledge, yes.
Okay, and then I have one other question, mm-hmm. if I could. Section 5.5 says, reach target populations by advertising or otherwise distributing information through small business development centers. And the rest of the section, it talks about informing small business and small business. What's a target population?
That's a very good question. Target populations are the communities in which we serve, and it is intended that that language suggest that our small business owners are a singular focus for us. We are resource centers within communities, and every community is different. And so my understanding is that that would be the intent of that language.
Thank you.
Representative Gomberg, would you like to add to that?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You know, every community is different and every target group is committee, but I'd like to give you an example from my own community. 25% of my constituents are over the age of 65. And in their retirement, they're exploring a number of different kinds of activities or pastimes. And a lot of people take up painting. And after they fill up their own walls, and after they fill up all the walls of all their relatives and friends, they decide that they might start selling their paintings. And suddenly they've got a business. They don't know anything about marketing, about taxation, and about how to structure their business. So they go to their small business development centers. Our SBDC recognized this as an important low-profile aspect of our community economy and started putting programs together to teach artists who are starting businesses how to help those businesses thrive and succeed. The problem is that they couldn't reach out in the art community, or they couldn't reach out through the galleries. They just simply had to use no-cost word of mouth to present this opportunity. And while it was effective and successful, I think it could have been much more successful had they had the opportunity to do some formal marketing rather than informal marketing.
Thank you. Great. And any other questions for our witness? Thank you so much for being here today. Now,
thank you.
We do not have the Dash 1 amendment to make available at this time, but also crucially, and I'm not sure if the where that will go, but I also know that we don't have the paperwork to move the bill today. So that was a good opportunity to hear more about the bill, and we will set it for a work session coming up. And in the meantime, we'll look to the proponents for word on the Dash 1.
You like it, I like it.
Thank you. All right.
Do I need to close this public hearing?
All right, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2152 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2153. Mr. Crawford, if you could please introduce the bill for us, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2153 requires the Oregon Business Development Department to establish a voluntary registry for commercial interior designers. It requires Business Oregon to adopt rules establishing minimum education and experience required for a person to be included on the registry. Allows commercial interior designers included on the registry to create and supervise the carrying out of plans, drawings, and specifications for a building, so long as the built plans, drawings, and specifications do not include structural systems or the building's envelope.
Okay, wonderful. We have quite a number of people signed up to testify, and I would like to initially invite up a panel of three of the proponents of the bill. It's not clear to me exactly whom would are the people who've signed up who would be the three proponents to begin. Welcome. And then for obvious reasons, I'll ask you to state your name for the record.
Yes. My name is Ellie Kuzik. I'm an independent interior designer, and I'm on the board for IDC Oregon.
Wonderful. And so the way we'll work it, and we are thankful to you for coming here, it's particularly important when people whose day jobs, unlike ours, are not spent here every single day, when you make the time to come talk to us. So wherever you are on the bill, we really appreciate your making the time to talk to us. The way we run this is we'll invite panels up of three people at a time. We're starting with a panel of the proponents of the bill, and then we'll move to a panel of people who are concerned about and or neutral on the bill. And then when you speak, we'll ask you to introduce yourself for the record and then provide your comments. Since you're the first panel up, you may want to lay some of the groundwork for the bill so that our committee can have the best understanding of the need that you believe it will meet. And you may go in any order, but please start with your name.
Hi. I'm Alicia Snyder-Carlson. I am a proponent of IDC of the bill and with IDC Oregon, the current co-chair. With Beth Ann, where are you? Sorry. We have a presentation for you, or slides to go along with the testimony, just to illustrate some of our points. Maybe. There's a special trick to get the projector on.
We'll get that taken care
okay.
of. Thanks.
Well, I guess I'll just start with who I am. So I'm Alicia Snyder-Carlson. I am Representative Leininger's constituent, and again with IDC Oregon. I am here to testify on behalf of the bill. I'm currently a green building consultant. My education is in interior design, and it was a unique path for me to come to green building consulting. Mostly my education prepared me to help coordinate with all of the various disciplines on a construction and design team. You'll hear a little bit more about that later today as we talk. So beyond just interior designers, we have a number of supporters of the bill, and they include architects, other design firms, independent designers, industry professionals such as manufacturers of flooring and other types of materials, post-secondary schools, the green building industry, and other professional allies.
I wanted to note that the projector is warming up. So, oh, there it is.
Perfect.
So,
thank you. So there's that list that I just mentioned. And I want to pause here for just a minute to fully help you understand the scope of work that a commercial interior design is typically responsible for. On this slide, you see the smaller diagram shows what an architect's scope of work is. It's typically the core and shell, the windows, the structural items, elevators, other egress paths within the building, such as fire exits and stairwells. The interior designer often is responsible for all of the interior scope of work. It's not to say that an architect wouldn't do that or can't do that. They certainly can. But oftentimes, especially in larger architecture firms, it's the interior designer that is responsible for that scope of work. It includes meeting all of the code requirements, both accessibility and building code requirements for access and egress. And as you can see, it's pretty complicated. This is an office space, and there's a lot going on here. We also are responsible for things on the interior, environmental conditions, such as indoor air quality and specifying of materials that have less off-gassing to keep occupants healthy. And to further illustrate the point, I'm sorry that this image is not that great. I do have a copy of the plans for you that I can share afterwards. Ellen has some of them here. But basically, we want to point out that the work that we do is very complex. We are coordinating with a contractor, an architect, an engineer, and all the other disciplines on a job site, including subcontractors. We have responsibility, again, for the ADA compliance, and that's wheelchair access in restrooms, as well as the rest of the space, and other disabilities as well. So a few demographics of the Oregon interior design profession. You can see here this data was put together by the International Interior Design Association, the Oregon chapter specifically, and a survey went out to firms across the state. And what we found is that the vast majority of interior designers in the state are women. In addition to that, every project or 3 out of 4 projects included an interior designer on the project team. And then further, some of the project types that we work on include corporate offices, healthcare, higher education, multifamily housing, and retail. So a lot of spaces that the public are impacted or could be impacted. Some more specific data about the interior design sector in Oregon. This is data from the 2016 Bureau of Labor and Statistics. And what was found is that the interior design industry has benefits to the building profession beyond just interior designers. A good example of that is that in Oregon, there are just about 3,000 jobs. Around 1,300 of those jobs are related to interior design occupations within the industry, so manufacturers, representatives, and what have you. And then 1,800 jobs are actually related to interior design specifically. Additionally, we found that $19.1 million came from tax revenue to the state from the interior design profession. So taking a quick step back, why we're here today is for our bill to establish a registry for commercial interior designers. The biggest reason we're here is that the current statute, which you see on the screen, indicates that a registered design professional can submit plans for permit. Interior designers are the only unregulated profession in Oregon with one of the biggest scopes of work in a public building. So I'm going to go through these pretty quickly, but we feel these are our top 4 reasons for interior design regulation within the state. We feel that by creating a registry will establish a way for interior designers to become a registered design professional. It'll open up work on federal projects as well as larger projects that we're prohibited from working on. So we're really looking at this as a way to remove a barrier to our practice. For women designers in larger firms, it also provides the opportunity to have a controlling interest in that firm by being a registered design professional. As I mentioned, the vast majority of people working in interior design are women, so we feel this is a small business and women-supported effort. Oftentimes, as small business owners, we're not able to practice to the fullest extent of our abilities, and we're often having to bring on other registered design professionals to help move our projects forward. This bill will help us increase the number of, will allow a greater number of businesses to compete for commercial design work without going to another design professional to get our work approved. We also feel that this is going to provide consumer choice and protection. As you mentioned, we have a pretty big scope of work within the built environment. And again, we're the only unregulated profession doing work in the built environment. And lastly, one of the biggest reasons is also a sustainable future. Oregon supports green buildings, and we have a lot to do with that in terms of indoor air quality, the materials that we specify, how they off-gas in spaces. That's one of the reasons I became an interior designer, because I have asthma, and I'm greatly impacted by the indoor air quality within spaces, so I wanted to see that evolution furthered in my practice. So we know that you'll hear from the opposition, and we just want to restate some of the things that we feel that this bill will do and will not do. We do not believe that it will require greater state oversight. The authority having jurisdiction will continue to do that, otherwise known as like the permitting department. They will still review all of our plans. We won't be able to do anything that architects aren't allowed to do and what have you. So we're still regulated by all the same codes. We will not be able to supervise construction. Only general contractors are allowed to do that. We are just focusing on the preparation of the plans for construction, again, which are reviewed by the permitting department. We believe that this will remove a current barrier. In the current code, there's a 4,000 square foot limit to the work that you can do if you're not a registered design professional. And so this registry would remove that. It also opens the door for us to work on federal projects again. Most federal projects require a registered design professional. And finally, we think that this bill will hold designers to the highest standards by establishing education experience and examination requirements within the rulemaking process for the registry. And that's all I have.
Wonderful, thank you. I'm gonna ask each of you to provide your remarks and then we can have questions at the end of that. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for meeting with us this morning. My name is Elizabeth Lockwood. I'm lead faculty at the Art Institute of Portland. I manage the interior design curriculum for the CETA institution that we're at. And I wanted to speak on behalf of IDC to let you guys understand the curriculum that's prepared for interior design commercial designers. So some of the key things I wanted to tease out were some standards from the CETA curriculum, and I have that as a reference for anyone if they would like to refer to that later. Standard 6 is business practices and professionalism, and it states interior designers understand the principles and processes that define the profession and the value of interior designers to society. The intent of this is standards ensures graduates understand accepted standards of practice, are ready to contribute to a variety of professional work environments, and are aware of the interrelationships that influence design, such as design responsibility, including ethics. Examples can include intellectual property, copyright issues, and conflict of interest. Standard 15 is construction. Interior designers understand interior construction and its relationship with base building construction and systems. So relating back to what Alicia mentioned about the floor plan is everything from the interior in that's non-structural. Interior designers are oftentimes managing. So the intent of this standard is to ensure graduates have an understanding of documentation, specification of materials and building systems, environmental impact, application of non-load-bearing interior construction methods, systems, and details associated. The last standard I want to highlight, standard 16, regulations and guidelines. Interior designers apply laws, codes, standards, and guidelines that impact the human experience of interior spaces. The intent is that standards ensure graduates understand their role in protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the building occupants and their various regulatory entities that impact practice. Graduates should apply laws, codes, standards, and guidelines impacting the development of solutions throughout the design process. Examples include the International Building Code, which Oregon has adopted, and the American Disabilities Act, which we refer to as ADA. Because these standards, students that come from CETA institutions are prepared to work in the interior design profession. Many of them go on to work at large architectural firms such as Sarah Architects, Ingram Moisen Architects, or Bora Architects. The educational preparation for the profession allows them to collaborate with multifaceted design teams such as architects, engineers, and contractors, as Alicia stated. All of these are required to be registered in the state of Oregon. Currently, interior designers may go on to take the National Interior Design Qualification Examination, called NCIDQ. However, taking this examination is not currently recognized by the state of Oregon. Currently in Oregon, 3 out of 5 undergraduate programs that offer interior design bachelors are CETA accredited: the Art Institute of Portland, Merrillhurst University, and the University of Oregon. Students invest time and money to obtain a degree that prepares them for the profession. Students graduate from CETA-accredited institutions with working knowledge to navigate the local jurisdictions, assure fire and life safety in buildings, and create construction details that affect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Again, I'm in support of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions when you guys are ready.
Great, thank you.
I actually have no testimony. I'm just here to help answer questions when they come up. Thank you.
Excellent. Committee, do we have any questions for this panel? Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe of you three, or maybe perhaps because you're from the school, could answer the question because it was brought up in one of the slides. Pure curiosity question. What percentage of interior design, the IDC, you talked about are run by women in Oregon. Do you have a percent, just a raw, rough number of percentage of the business?
We don't.
50?
Less than that. I would say that most of the sole proprietors are women.
Okay.
And we don't have a clear record of how many sole proprietors there are in the state.
Okay.
One of the reasons for that is that interior design within the Bureau and Labor, how they recognize the statistics of interior design are often grouped with manufacturers of materials and other professions. So it's kind of hard to understand the data that's brought forward. So we look at it as best we can, but that's one of the holdbacks that we have.
Just small follow-up.
Please.
Thank you. And the only reason is because it was a main point of one of your slides. So I just wanted to know what's backing that up.
Oh, so that data specifically was put obtained from a survey within the state of Oregon. It went to over 200 firms within the state, and all the responses were gathered and formulated from that information.
Okay. But we don't know a percentage. Is it a lot?
It's a lot of
okay.
women.
Sorry, I'm just trying to get a number of some sort.
No, that's great. Yep. So
because it's an important point you've made.
Yes. So 32% of interior designers are in an architecture firm, and of those 32% of interior designers, 93% of interior designers are women, and 3% are female. Sorry, I had the data
93%
right in front of me.
Of the 32%.
Of the 32% of interior designers
okay.
within architecture firms.
Thank you very much,
yes.
Madam Chair. That's what I need.
Okay, great. And Representative Brocksmith had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you so much for taking the time to be here and discuss this topic, because I know that you've been working on this issue for quite some time. So just some technical questions. Can you explain the criteria that will be necessary for an interior designer to join this registry that this bill will create?
It would be a combination of...
And can you introduce yourself as before you begin?
Ellen Cusick. It would be a combination of education, years of experience, and having taken a qualifying examination, which would probably be the NCIDQ exam, which is offered twice a year. Across the country and in Canada as well.
Sweet. Great.
So,
please go ahead.
I have a number of questions. Actually.
Okay. And then after you, we've got Representative Reschke.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can we get into more detail with regards to the education that's necessary? And so
absolutely. The National Council for Interior Design Qualifications requires, they have several paths that you can follow to take the exam, starting with an associate's degree in interior design. Then you have to have a certain number of years of experience, and then you can apply to take the exam. So it starts with an associate's, and then it moves on to a bachelor's from a CETA-accredited school, a second degree in interior design, whether it's a bachelor's or a master's, thank you. Architects are qualified to take the exam with a certain number of years of experience. So the examination itself is set up in such a way that you can't just graduate from high school and decide, I'm going to be an interior designer and take the exam. You have to prove that you've had this education and years of experience. So the minimum qualification is an associate's in interior design, and there's a 40-hour option and a 60-hour option for that associate's. I believe it's in 2018, they're going to eliminate the 40 hours of interior design coursework, and you will have had to have 60 hours of interior design coursework for 60 credit hours, excuse me, for an associate's in order to be able to take the exam. Does that clarify?
Yeah, somewhat, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
So, of course, just like an attorney, you can't just go and take the bar.
Exactly.
Right? And so what you're saying is that the threshold is going to be the exam, because they won't be able to... So you don't need a master's in interior design in order to be join the registry, because what you need is at least the associates or the coursework that allows you the knowledge to pass the exam.
Exactly.
So the exam is going to be the threshold.
The exam will be the threshold, and then there will be continuing education requirements along with that. So you'll need to maintain a certain number of hours of is it IDET? No, it's a...
IDCEC, which is the Interior Design Council for Education.
Continuing?
I submit them all the time, and I'm like, there's so many acronyms. It's an institution that manages IIDA and ASID's continuing education credits. So IIDA, the International Interior Design Association, is a professional organization that you can join as a member and you can be an associate without your NCIDQ. If you have your NCIDQ, you're a professional member, and with that you then have, it's 6 to 10 hours a year of continuing education that you're required to do with that membership.
And our registry would require at least that same amount of continuing education.
Okay, yes, you may.
Thank you. And so who will determine which individuals have met the criteria to join the registry?
We're not entirely sure about that. So one of the issues that we had when we were pursuing past legislation was that because interior designers are not registered, there's no definition for them in statutes, it was difficult to pursue licensing because we're not really recognized. So we're kind of working backwards now and trying to fill in the blanks and the holes that are currently in statute. Our understanding is that in the rulemaking process, all of this will get fleshed out, and we'll need to, you know, work with stakeholders and understand what their pain points are to make sure that it's a fair rules for everybody. We believe it will go under DCSB. Department of Consumer Business Services, and that they will regulate that process, the registration process. And within NCIDQ, you can verify whether you passed that exam, and so they would probably provide, like, transcripts to confirm their education, similar to what, like, an architect would do to become registered or licensed. Does that help?
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Reschke. And then after that, I think if we have no more questions for this panel, we'll move forward to some other panels, because you folks really are on the hot seat being the first ones up. But we'll have questions for others, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming. And how many here are interior designers in the room? Because my guilty pleasure is to watch interior design shows at night. So thanks for coming.
That's more than we need to know.
Yeah.
Property Brothers, Fixer Upper, okay. So when I'm looking at a piece of legislation, I have three questions. I'm always looking at cost versus benefit, and then is there any harm that's being alleviated from the current process that exists? So I didn't see any cost analysis in this, but the state's being required to put up a registry, which I'm assuming requires building a database, building some sort of web interface. Somebody's going to have to answer phone calls. Am I on it? Am I not? So I'm just wondering where the cost analysis to this is to the state, or does this department have extra resources that it's just waiting to be used?
So I will answer that. You'll be pleased to hear. When we analyze bills, when they get to a certain point of readiness, we get a fiscal impact statement.
Sure.
That signifies how much it will cost the state if the bill is passed. And so since we are at kind of the first stage in consideration, we don't yet have the fiscal, because there may still be some moving pieces in the proposed bill, but we will have that.
Okay.
I think, and then you can start speaking to this, I noticed that some parts of the bill seem to be structured to limit agency costs, but there probably will be some agency costs.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up then, and thank you, Madam Chair, why doesn't the industry do it themselves? Why is the burden being put on the taxpayer to fund this effort or to go through this effort?
So there is one other state, California, that's self-regulated, mm-hmm. and it's not government registry. Okay. Their certification is not. They are pursuing it through the government, but there are other challenges that are created by not being government regulated. And one is that when you go to the permitting department, they don't recognize your qualifications. Okay. Regardless of what certificate you have, if it's not government regulated. That's the biggest one.
Okay. Thank you.
May I jump into, is it the case that this would be a fee, that fees right. paid by the individuals would cover the cost of operating
yes,
the program?
That's
so that's
the
fairly
plan.
Typical structure
right.
for programs that we run.
Yep. Ideally, we are thinking it would be around $200 in an individual. That's typical in other states that are surrounding us. Utah just passed a bill, and that's what they're looking at. So we would hope that those fees would cover the cost to the state. We understand that that won't be upfront, that there'll be some upfront monies and, you know, to establish things before people actually get to pay.
Okay.
But that we are hopeful that it doesn't cost the state money.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. And now I would like to call forward a panel of three who have concerns about the bill or are neutral on it. Arlene Davis of AIA Oregon, Ron Vandehey of ACEC Oregon, and Kirsten Adams from AGC Oregon Columbia. Welcome. And again, feel free to speak in any order and just begin your remarks by stating your name for the record. Thanks.
Okay. Hello, I am Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Ron Vandehey. I'm representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. I'm against this bill. Let's just start off with its reason for being against it is for public safety reasons. As an engineer, we're required to go to usually 4 years of education, and then after that education is complete, we're required to study under another licensed engineer for 4 years before we're able to take an examination. So when we get done with school, we think we know what we know, and as soon as we start our job, we find out we know nothing, and we have to learn from the professional what's, how to apply our skills and how to be safe for the public. And then in my office, even after it's been completed and by our staff, it's reviewed by one of the partners to make sure it's safe before it goes out the door. What I'm seeing in this bill is they're relying on the jurisdiction to be their reviewers of to make sure that it meets code and in compliance. It's not being done internally because the experience isn't there. And that's where we get down to, you don't know what you don't know. So that's where the mistakes are usually made. If you don't understand something, you can easily make an error. And just to take an example on the structural end of it, if you take a beam that is a wood beam and it's specified as a glulam on the plans, and a contractor comes in and says, I would like to replace that with a solid sawn beam of the same dimensions, you think that would be an easy switch out. And especially you think a glulam beam is just a matter of little pieces that are glued together. Well, that's not the case. A glulam beam is almost twice as strong as a solid sawn beam because we take the best parts of the wood and laminate it together to make that beam. And so you wouldn't know to go back to the professional and say, hey, is this a problem or not a problem? One of the things in the bill, it talks about structural systems. So they're trying to be safe. They're trying to explain, we're not going to touch the structural portion of the building. But there's many things in the building that are non-structural that have to be designed. And again, in the bill, who decides what is structural, what is not structural? The projector hanging from your ceiling is a non-structural element. But if it falls down and hits somebody in the head, it's definitely going to be a problem. Your ceiling system is considered a non-structural system. But yet, if it's not wired up correctly and supported, we have an earthquake, it falls down and can cause harm and damage. CMU walls inside of a building that don't go up to the structure, that are partition walls, are considered non-structural. But if they fall over and hit somebody because they're not braced properly, they're definitely going to cause harm. And so we want to make sure we separate out those items from structural and non-structural. And in this bill, there is nothing to tell me who makes the determination of what, other than the main structural columns, that they can do the design elements on. So there's a lot of vagueness in the bill itself. When you go through and look at there's a lot of things here that would allow for them to be able to do construction services on items they don't understand. So as an engineer, I am required to have some basic knowledge of other types of engineering. So I'll have classes in mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, structural engineering, civil engineering, and traffic. So just so I have a basic understanding of what those items are, so that I'll know to go to those professionals when I have questions during construction services, that those actually need to go to those particular branches where there's professional knowledge and expertise in. I don't make decisions on the go that say, this is okay or this isn't okay. You need to have an understanding that one thing can affect five other things in the building. So it might be okay that I switch out the electrical panel for this particular type of other panel, but it may be affecting my ability for security down the road for that to operate because it's intertwined with each other. Now, as engineers, we are required to stay within our field of design. We're not allowed to go outside of it. And part of that is in item 3 of this bill, where it talks about ORS 671 through all the way through chapter 701. That is enforcement. So if I step outside and I start designing electrical work, even though I'm a structural engineer, and start making errors on that, and the building official sees that, they can have my license reviewed by the state board to make sure that I'm staying within the boundaries. This bill eliminates that. So there is no enforcement when there's a problem that they're stepping outside their boundaries of where they should be doing their work. So I've worked with a lot of jurisdictions, and in smaller jurisdictions don't have specialists. They can't afford them. They don't have enough work going through the door. And so if you rely on the jurisdictions to do the review, in many cases, they're in a similar situation with the interior designer. They have some general knowledge, and they do ask for help. Many times when they find a complicated building coming into their process, they'll hire out. Even my firm gets involved where they will hire us out as an outside source of expertise. So to put that burden on the public is not a wise thing to do as far as public safety goes. And that's basically what I'm here today is to make sure that I don't have anything against having a registry that has a list of people that want to be known as interior designers and then them having a criteria, but this bill is way too far-reaching and can get us into serious trouble. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that comment. And I think we'll continue down the line before we have full questions. But I just want to note that two key things that I heard you say are that there would need to be clarification of parts of this legislation, and rulemaking often is a good place to have clarification like that in many ways. But that also there are some tasks that engineers do that it would absolutely not be appropriate to have interior design consultants do, and I think I certainly think that's valid, and I perceive that that's what the interior design consultants here would also agree to. So I guess the project for us will be to try to create the right delineation, and I appreciate your identifying ways that maybe you feel like the delineation right now is not quite right, and I'm hopeful that through the course of the next few weeks we can find a delineation that meets the goals of the interior design professionals but also responds in a meaningful way to concerns that you've raised. So thank you.
Hi. Good morning, Madam Chair, representatives on the committee. My name is Aline Davis, and I am the president of the American Institute of Architects Oregon, or AIA. I've been in the architecture profession in Oregon for over 20 years, and throughout that time I've worked side by side with interior designers. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I think that the foremost message that the AIA has on this particular bill is that we do support registration and recognition of interior designers. The work that they do is very important. Architects work alongside engineers and interior designers to ensure the health, safety, and welfare of the public, and we all contribute to that effort. Their desire to be recognized for the work that they do is legitimate, and we support that. We do not, however, support this bill as currently written for some of the reasons that my colleague here has stated, and I'll go into a little bit more detail into that. I do think it's important to note that our concern is about the legal and financial accountability that the legislator has previously deemed as necessary to ensure the safety of the public in the built environment through delineation of roles and the licensing and registration requirements that go along with that. Many professionals, including architects, have pledged their support for this particular legislation, and we believe that these are good people who hearts are in the right place, and they're supporting the interior design professionals, but we'd argue that they either haven't carefully read the language that's in the House bill, or they don't fully understand what that language states. We, again, join interior architects who are our colleagues in this desire, but again, the concept or the specific language doesn't work. The concept of a voluntary registry for highly skilled and highly trained interior designers to distinguish them from others, interior decorators and the like, makes sense, and we support this approach. The three E's should be used for recognition of these professionals, and those are education, experience, and exam. The registry should provide information about schooling, time in business, and detailing of focus and specialty skills and certification by the National Council for Interior Design Qualifications, or NCIDQ, through examination. AIA Oregon has suggested that such a registry include a number for those who are qualified and accepted for enrollment that could then be used for advertising, website, business cards, etc. This would allow Oregon consumers to make intelligent decisions with knowledge about higher levels of education, experience, and exam that have been achieved for interior designers that would be listed on the registry. Architecture firms do not, in response to an earlier comment, do not need to be solely owned by architects. The firms that I have worked with in the private sector, and I've worked in both public and private sector, have had partners or principals that were interior designers. So that is not, I believe, a valid argument. We do support this effort, what it means for highly skilled interior designers to work with, but we cannot support the part of the bill that starts with notwithstanding, which means set aside everything else in the law. Through its current language, the bill says to ignore architect, engineer, and construction contractor laws for those in the interior on the interior design registry. I don't believe that was the intent, but it is how it is currently written. It states that interior designers can execute activities that are otherwise reserved for these other licensed professionals, and that they can do so without the accountability sideboards that the other professions must adhere to, like licensing, bonding, liability insurance, notice of defect, warranty requirements, complaint and appeal processes, and penalties. The legislator decided that the health, safety, and welfare of Oregonians required a closer examination of the products that result from the work of these professionals. And the legislator decided to limit certain activities to specifically trained and licensed people and then hold those people accountable to the citizens of our state. The Architecture Practice Act 671.010 to 671.220 describes activities that are not considered the practice of architecture and therefore may be freely engaged in by interior designers. House Bill 2153, however, whether intended or not intended, allows interior designers to create and oversee implementation of building construction with only the exception of the building envelope, which separates the inside from the outside, and structural supports. But the reality is that it's far more complex than that when doing building and construction projects, whether they be from the ground up or a remodel. That means that interior designers on the registry could, if they choose to, design and provide supervisory services during construction of a building's mechanical, electrical, plumbing, ventilation, emergency ingress and egress, energy saving, fire and life safety, and other systems, and would be responsible to make sure that those all meet building codes, regardless of the fact that they're not specifically trained and licensed to provide such services. Our final concern, to Representative Reske's point, is that we think the bill causes more work for the Business Development Department than they realize. There'll be rules. They will have to write rules, check education, qualifications, and exam requirements for those applying for the registry, ensure that those on the registry are not executing envelope or structural support work, and ensure that those who are not on the registry are not doing what those on the registry are allowed to do. This will cost considerable time and money. For the 2015 Bureau of Labor Statistics report, between 510 and 1,190 Oregonians report being interior designers. Again, the definition is very loose. So if we look to the American Society of Interior Designers as a more specific target in that range, they state that there are 530 interior designers in Oregon. Using those numbers, if every interior designer applied for and was accepted for the registry, a fee of $200, as stated earlier, would raise only $106,000. While a fee of $500 would raise $265,000, we don't understand how that revenue would be sufficient for the business development department to provide the oversight and regulation of the activities that the bill would mandate as currently written. There may be enough funds for the department to keep track of a voluntary registry, which AIA Oregon supports based on those three E's of education, experience, and exam, but not enough to regulate the interior design activities, which the last part of the bill requires. We would propose to strike paragraph 3 and its related references for its unintended consequences. We support registration and recognition, but not a redefining of the practices of the professions that are responsible for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Alternatively, we would welcome the opportunity to engage with and jointly develop language that strengthens the interior design profession without creating unintended consequences for other licensed professionals and the public. I want to thank you for your time, attention, and care, careful consideration of the wording of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kirsten Adams with Associated General Contractors, Oregon Columbia Chapter. AGC is the state's largest commercial construction association, representing a very broad cross-section of our industry. We are currently working with legal counsel to determine the impacts this bill might have on our members and are still in the process of our due diligence. At this point, we would just like to put a couple questions and concerns we have on the record. These include concerns about the definition of building envelope and structural systems and making sure that these are in line with definitions throughout other rules and statutes. Our attorneys are currently looking into these definitions to ensure that there's this uniformity. Also, we're concerned with the potential breadth of Section 1, Subsection 3, as my other two colleagues have mentioned, and concerns that it might be too ambiguous to determine the extent to which interior designers will be able to construct a new structure. We were unaware of this bill before seeing it in the bill stack, and so, as I mentioned, we're continuing to do our due diligence surrounding our concerns. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to say I really appreciate this conversation here today. I think that examining the pros and cons and different perspectives really helps us fine-tune legislation and come back with a better response. I had two questions, if I may. First of all, I heard some concerns about safety issues. And I'm reading in the draft of the bill here, and it says that structural systems mean the framework, load-bearing walls, building core, and columns and other load-bearing elements of a building and any other building elements that require design computations in order to ensure adequate building structural support. And I heard the concern expressed that if interior designers can't do these things, they can still do things that affect the safety of the building. How would you change that section to address the safety concerns that you've shared with us?
Well, I haven't really looked at wording for this. You know, it would make a difference. I mean, really, how design practice currently is set up with, you know, engineers doing engineers' work, you know, you could take out that they should not provide any, you know, engineering you know, whatsoever. I mean, that's not what they're rather than trying to define it as very particular items, you'd make it much more broad where that would not apply at all.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a second quick question. And again, I appreciate the feedback we're getting here. I'm hearing support for a registry. I'm hearing some concern about who gets registered and how. I'm just trying to get a good sense of how as an Oregon consumer, I can draw a distinction between people who have education and experience in this subject area as opposed to people like Representative Rushkie and myself who are just fans of the Home and Garden Channel and hold ourselves out as experts. How do we draw that distinction in a way that Oregon consumers can understand?
Madam Chair, Representative, I do think that the registry notion as presented by the interior design profession is valid, and the education requirements, the exam requirements, and having a designation as an interior design professional is good for the industry. It will be helpful. It's helpful to architects and engineers and the public as well as interior design professions. The problem that we have with the bill as currently stated is it wipes out the practice acts for the architects and the engineers for the areas that we have primary responsibility for around public safety in the design, and indicates that interior designers can do all of that work except for, you know, the outside wall and the primary building structural elements. Primary building structural elements are what keep the building up. They are not all of what protects the health, safety, and welfare of the populations that are within the buildings. There's a lot of other engineering that has to be done within the building for various different systems. There's a lot of other detailing that is done by the architects within those building systems as well. And so the problem with this bill isn't the idea that we want a higher standard and that certain interior designers within the profession should be able to achieve that, have that recognition, and be able to market themselves to the public. The problem is that it's wiping out the architect and engineer responsibilities within the building, and intentionally or not, allowing interior designers who don't have the same training and specific skill set requirements to do that work without any of the parameters that the architects and engineers are held to. And I think that's really the core issue here. It's not that any of us are anti-interior design professionals. It's that we're trying to avoid catastrophe in the language of a bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. So we've got about seven additional people who would like to present. So thank you for your comments and for being here. And now we will move to another panel of proponents, and then we'll have a final panel of people who are concerned.
Thank you.
Actually, we have too many people for only one more panel of proponents, but we'll make this work. Okay, let's have all four of the remaining proponents come forward. Roberta Pennington, Elsa Long, Emma Abramowitz, and Carol Mack, please. And then we're going to follow up with a panel that features Betsy Earls and Cindy Robert. And then we're going to declare victory on the public hearing and adjourn. So thank you for being here. And we can maybe you can shift as people's turn at the mic changes so that this nice woman has access to the mic when it's her turn. Thank you. Welcome. Please begin by stating your name for the record.
Hi. I apologize if I'm shaking. I'm so excited. I'm like a chihuahua when I do public speaking. Okay. And that's on the record now. Great. Okay. Committee members, good morning. My name is Roberta Pennington, and I am an NCIDQ certified commercial interior designer. I'm a registered non-affiliated voter who lives in District 23 in Northeast Portland. Go Roseway. I'm a former president of IIDA Oregon and former vice president of advocacy for the chapter as well. I am a senior associate at Ankrum Moisson Architects in Portland, Oregon, a firm that grew from two guys in a house to 350 employees, including 55 qualified commercial interior designers in Portland, Seattle, and San Francisco. I write to you today, ask for professional recognition of commercial interior design in the state of Oregon. State recognition gives the consumer the ability to make an educated choice when hiring a design professional. My best example for explaining the difference between architecture versus commercial interior design is my experience with breast cancer. I was initially diagnosed by my general practitioner. She, in turn, referred me to my oncologist, who then referred me to a surgical oncologist for removal of the cancer, and finally referred to a plastic surgeon who reconstructed my chest. Now you're all looking at my chest, aren't you? No, that's on the record, too. That's great. Each one of these professionals went through a basic education in medicine to get a primary level of practice. They then went on to focus on a field of specialty, which led to practicum, or residency, and then examination. Similarly, interior designers are educated in many of our nation's colleges side by side with would-be architects the first 2 years. My college, Kent State University, go Flashes, does this, as does the University of Oregon, go Ducks, where many Oregon architects and designers are trained. Commercial interior designers then undergo 2 years minimum supervised practice to qualify to sit for our certifying exam, the NCIDQ. We then collaborate extensively with our core and shell counterparts in architecture. We focus, though, on the practice of built interiors and relating to the human experience. So our stuff touches people the most. I ask for recognition of this education, experience, and examination. I may have flair, it's true. I may have fun, you may have noticed that too. But I also have a Bachelor of Arts cum laude from the College of Architecture and Environmental Design, a current NCIDQ certification, and 15 years practicing commercial interior design. Now, we've had a lot of code talk, and I know code talk is super dry, but here it is. We talked a bit about the OSSC, or the Oregon Structural Specialty Code. So then Chapter 1, this one is the one that gets quoted and thrown around quite a bit, is submittal documents. So here is the biggie, the one that when I was a sole proprietor and worked in a firm that was only interior designers to get our projects permitted, we threw this around quite a bit. The construction documents shall be prepared by a registered design professional. So it doesn't say architect, it doesn't say engineer, it says registered design professional, oh boy, where required by the statute of the jurisdiction in which the project is to be constructed. Where special conditions exist, the building official is authorized to require additional construction documents to be prepared by a registered design professional. There's a few exceptions then listed underneath. I won't go through the whole thing, but the one that I highlight. Plans, specifications, calculations, diagrams, and other data prepared and designed by an engineer or architect licensed by the state to practice as such are not required for the following work, provided the building official determines that the work is not of a highly technical nature or there is no unreasonable potential risk to life and or safety of the structure. There's a few exceptions that roll around. We talked about square footage. I'm sure some of my friends here will be talking about those square footage limitations. And that deals with new structures. So we're talking about new footprint of a building, whether it's a new building or an addition built to it. So those where the restrictions lie. But when you're talking about like for like, this exception comes into place. It's called alteration or repairs that do not involve the structural parts of the building. So it's already baked into the code. Sounds about right. So Chapter 2 then tells us this, a registered design professional. This is all about definitions. Well, like I said, code, good stuff. An individual who is registered or licensed to practice their respective design profession as defined by the statutory requirements of the professional registration laws of the state or jurisdiction in which the project is to be constructed. So what that says is architects have a registration, engineers have a registration. Where do interior designers lie? The same with contractors. They even have a registration. So when I go in as a sole proprietor and I have something that the where I meet all the minimum requirements to get a permit, if the plans examiner is following some of these statutes and interpreting it differently, they may deem it as a highly technical nature and tell me to hit the bricks. So there's another reference manual that floats around in all these jurisdictions. The reference manual for building officials, the architect's law and the engineer's law, as prepared by the Oregon Architects Examiners, Oregon State Board of Engineers, and Land Serving, in conjunction with the Oregon Codes Division. So this is a manual given to plans examiners, written by architects and engineers, for them to interpret the code. So this is coming from them. Chapter 2. It does like this nice little question-answer back and forth. It makes it very lively. Chapter 2 is an architect or engineer required on a project. Besides the OSSC, there are three definitions from architects and engineers' laws and rules for a project to be assessed by the building official. Exempt buildings. You're going to hear this around, too. Exempt versus non-exempt. I'm going to focus on exempt. Woo. The architects and engineers' laws and rules provide an area where a person who is not registered as an architect or engineer may plan, design, and supervise the erection, enlargement, or alteration of a building. these buildings are exempt. And when I talk about the part where I said the new footprint, again, it's limited in square footage per law currently. What I'm focusing on, though, is the interior, like for like. We're not changing the footprint of the building. That's the number five exception. I know I think the big one is like they talk about farmhouses and ancillary buildings where you put your lawnmower. Like we could design that all the live long day. Anyway, number five, the planning, designing, specifying, or supervising of the alteration or repairs to a building when the structural elements of the building are not involved and when the occupancy. It's again, like for like. It's an office, we're making a new office. It's a restaurant, we're making a new restaurant. So that doesn't change. And the classification of the building, like for like. We're not trying to change the building type or construction. So my engineer friend was talking about changing out a column type. That's not within our purvey or scope of work if we're following exempt building law. May an unregistered individual prepare plans and specifications for interior space planning and or remodeling of non-exempt structures? Yes. And so, again, this talks about the square footage bits. So that's under the ORS 671, the scintillating code that keeps getting brought up by everybody here today. It's good reads. Activities not considered as practice of architecture. Nothing in the law would prevent a person from planning, designing, specifying, or supervision the alterations or repairs to building A, the structural part of the building, including but not limited to the foundation, walls, floors, roof, footings, bearing partitions, beams, columns, and joists is not involved. B, the building code classification by use or occupancy of the building is not changed. Again, like for like, office for office. And then finally, the building code classification by type of construction of the building is not changed. We're not trying to change out columns. Question 10. Any other one than an architect or engineer prepare plans for submission to building officials? Big answer is yes, but only when the building falls into the exempt status. So that whole outline that I just yammered off before. However, even though the general public is allowed to prepare plans for submission on exempt structure, so like my husband, who is a stay-at-home dad, bless his sweet soul, he could put together construction documents. The building official has the authority to require drawings, calculations, and other related documents of an exempt structure to be prepared by a registered architect and or engineer if the building official establishes the work is of a highly technical nature or there's potential risk to the life and or safety of the structure. However, the building official cannot dictate the actual design. So in my practice, even now in a large firm where I work under the stamp of an architect, if something is a highly technical nature, like putting in a staircase, something as simple as a communication stair, I got to hire an engineer because no one under our roof is qualified to do that. And a building official will ask for that information, but he can't tell us if we can paint it purple or pink. So there's that. Finally, some huge benefits for registered commercial interior designers within the definition of registered design professional. It's qualification of our design counterparts. Woohoo! We talked about that. Qualification by the state and local facilitators for permitting. When I show up in jurisdictions where I currently can't permit, Salem, Gresham, Beaverton, they see the stamp, they understand that I am a registered design professional and therefore qualified to permit in an exempt building situation. Avoid redundant work. So that means that right now, if I go to those jurisdictions, I got to give my stuff to a registered architect. They have to redraw it, and that cost then gets filtered down to my client, which, yeah, we know that. Pay equality. Pay scale tells me that architects in the state of Oregon with 9 years plus experience on the 90th percentile, so this is the la-di-da architect, 86 grand tops out. At the same level of education and experience, an interior designer is quoted at 79. By recognizing our qualifications, a registered commercial interior designer will see this pay disparity equal out over time. We can only hope. Competition from small firms and sole proprietorships. We talked about that. Right now, the GSA defines only registered design professionals can bid out work within the GSA. Some of it is only interior design work that doesn't in any way touch structure. It doesn't touch the building envelope or core and shell. And finally, the ability for commercial interior design staff to move up in office hierarchy. So right now, when I am at Ancrum Moisson, the road to partner in no way talks about certification within interior designers. It means that we've brought in work and we're doing a great job being interior designers, but it doesn't matter if you've passed an exam or not. But the architects, on the other hand, in order to make principal, they have to be a registered architect. And so right now, my NCIDQ certificate looks beautiful and it collects a lot of dust on the wall. I thank you for your time today and look forward to ways that I and my constituency can help move HB 2153 forward. And thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. So we need to have each person probably take no more than 3 minutes at this point. And
okay.
So that we have questions and so that our final panel can present and answer questions also.
Sure. Okay, good morning. My name is Emma Abramowitz, and I'm here on behalf of Boer Architects in support of House Bill 2153. I graduated from the University of Oregon in 2012 with a bachelor's in interior architecture. It was at the U of O that I first learned of IDC Oregon's initiatives, including their nearly two-decade-long fight to establish parity in the architecture and design industry. I remember thinking, here I am studying interior architecture alongside my fellow architecture colleagues, putting in grueling hours in studio, working just as hard and feeling just as passionate about my career path, but upon graduation, I won't have the same rights to practice. I thought and still think it is absurd that I graduated from a 5-year professionally accredited design program, yet my professional title, interior designer, means nothing in the state of Oregon. This is only compounded by the fact that I've passed the NCIDQ exam and received no legal recognition in the state of Oregon. At this point in time, anyone can call themselves an interior designer. So far in my career, I've proudly worked and designed for Shriners Children's Hospital, OHSU, Oregon State University, the University of Colorado at Boulder, the University of New Mexico, and Beaverton South Cooper Mountain High School. Through these projects, I have been part of a diverse team of architects, contractors, structural engineers, and lighting designers who together make these buildings possible, and I do not see that teamwork going away. I am an interior designer, and without my deep knowledge in life safety, fire and building codes, and compliance with the ADA, and the ever-changing design trends affecting how we work and learn within the built environment, these projects would not succeed. Yet when my colleagues and I gather at a conference table, I am the one professional in the room that does not have legal backing from the state of Oregon. This bill does not prevent anyone from calling themselves an interior designer and does not limit entry into the profession. It simply creates a registry that will allow highly qualified individuals like me to practice the profession to the full extent of their education and experience. The passing of House Bill 2153 will offer qualified interior designers the choice to register themselves and to own a professional title that is legally recognized, granting them more equal rights to their colleagues and teammates in the conference room. For those reasons, I urge you to support House Bill 2153, and thanks for your time.
Thanks very much, and thanks for keeping that concise. That was great.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Elsa Long. I am a professional commercial designer at IA Interior Architects in the Portland office of a global firm, and I'm also here on behalf as the current president of the International Interior Design Association Oregon chapter, who we've heard a little bit about, and we saw the statistics from the survey that we sent out last year. I'm here to urge you to support this bill for several reasons. I will keep them very concise. One, for creating opportunities for economic growth in Oregon. We really believe that this will help more businesses allow to compete for the commercial design and to practice within their scope. We believe that this will allow a lot of the small businesses, primarily women-owned, as we discussed, to be more competitive with this professional designation, whether they're working as a sole proprietor or within a larger firm. We believe it increases job opportunities for recent Oregon grads. Like Emma, I had graduated from the University of Oregon with a Bachelor of Interior Architecture. We work a lot with some of the wonderfully accredited design programs that Elizabeth Lockwood mentioned earlier in helping transition those young students into their first steps into their career. It provides greater accountability for the registration of commercial interior designers and the qualifications, meeting the 3 E's that were discussed, and also that commercial interior designers keep Oregonians safer and promote sustainable practices. So as Alicia mentioned, indoor air quality, just general sustainability and sourcing things within Oregon, there's a big sustainability component that we are very deeply passionate about providing for Oregonians. We believe this registry would help the business where I am currently employed, as well as the businesses of my colleagues who's testified today. And I'd be happy to talk to you if you have more questions. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. And then maybe someone wants to switch places with this speaker so that it's easier to use the mic. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Carol Mack, and I'm a student at the Art Institute of Portland. And I'm here to speak to you about my concerns or my desire when I graduate, as I enter this profession. I think it's really important that my clients understand the training that I have, that I am a professional. This is actually my encore career. I come to this from after 40 years in the field of education, and I've watched that profession become more of a profession, and it largely started with a high percentage of women. So I think that what I really want to leave with the idea with you is that, you know, Oregon has the opportunity here to educate, help educate the people about what an interior designer is and what an interior designer does. The preparation that I received is highly rigorous, and you know, I'm an HGTV junkie as well, and as I'm going through this program, I'm becoming more and more aware of what it involves and what it doesn't involve. I don't want to be an engineer. I don't want to be an architect. Well, I might want to be those things, but that's not why I'm in the program. I'm in the program to be an interior designer, and I want to be a professional when I enter the profession. So I think this registry will do that for us, and it will be the first step in the education of the public about what interior designers do, and I think this would go a long way for that. So I appreciate your allowing me this testimony.
Great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair.
Yes, please, Rep. Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a former building code enforcement hearings officer, I don't find the testimony dry at all. These are important issues, and what occurred to me as a potential comparison, and I only want any of you to comment to the extent that you have actual knowledge, but it occurs to me that what you're asking for is not very much different than what so-called design build outfits ask for, and they range in complexity from being sort of one or two person operations up to, you know, a larger company. So if any of you feel comfortable commenting on the comparison between what design build firms already have in terms of certification and respect in the industry vis-a-vis our permitting people versus what you're asking for, I'd be interested to hear it.
Well, we do work with a lot of design build. I do, personally, because I specialize in tenant improvement and office work. So I am sitting down at the desk of code officials a lot of the year. Design build, I'm not 100% familiar, so I would definitely have to get back to you as far as what that certification process is. It's mostly work that's directed by the subs, so the people that do the installation create the drawings, so they have a very practical knowledge of systems going in, for example, mechanical work. So a mechanical contractor can create those drawings based on what they know will get approved in the field. I think there's a little bit of difference here and there. I don't want to call it diet architecture because we're not practicing architecture by any stretch, but it's so similar. But it's a more narrow focus of the human experience of going into a building and working with it. So I would say kind of.
So thank you. I want to encourage people to speak into the microphone just to make sure that on the record people can hear. And then I believe Representative Post had a comment.
Oh, I was pointing at him.
Oh, I see. And then Representative Brocksmith. And if that's it, we'll transition to the next panel.
Just a quick question. So I appreciate the testimony and, again, that you're being here and the dedication that you have to your trade. You know, what will happen... do you think will happen to the interior designers that might have been or might be established for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years but haven't gone through the coursework or haven't gone through the schooling that you're doing now? What is going to happen to their businesses?
I think it's important to note that we're talking about commercial interior design and impacting the code impacted environment. That's what we're designing for, and all the discussion around the health, safety, and well-being of the people that are using it. There's a distinction, obviously, in different levels of interior design where they might be practicing for residential interior design. Interior decorators are also a wonderful profession. It's just not the same as what we're talking about.
Maybe to be more focused, commercial interior designers who are practicing practicing today that maybe have 20, 30 years experience who weren't necessarily in a program that was CEDAR accredited, but they're practicing interior design at the same level. And this probably gets sussed out through rulemaking as to where we can grandfather in, where they're not taking the full exam, where we're focusing more on either the practicum portion of it so that it's relevant to today's practices, but not negating 20 years of practical experience that makes them qualified.
The three E's would still be applicable, though, yeah, for the education experience and the exam.
Experience would be a giant E versus a lowercase e.
This is Carol Mack again. I just want to say that I think that's one of the things that this registry will do, is it will elevate the profession. So those, you know, everyone will see what are the requirements to be on the registry. And I think, again, that will raise the level of professionalism. And consumers will have a choice about who they hire.
Great. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you to this panel. And now I'd like to welcome our final panel of people concerned about the bill, Betsy Earls, representing the Oregon Retail Council, and Cindy Robert, representing the American Institute of Architects. Welcome. And then I'm going to make a couple of comments at the end after we have final questions and we can think through our go-forward plan. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and the AOI Retail Council. The AOI Retail Council represents many segments of the retail industry, including general merchandise, department stores, mass merchandisers, fast food restaurants, chain drug and convenience stores, as well as many specialty retailers such as auto, book, and home improvement stores. Many of our members employ not only interior designers, but individuals who make design recommendations to consumers, both residential and small business, on a variety of things, including paint, shutters, kitchen and bathroom fixtures, flooring, blinds, desk setups, other things like that. The Retail Council is particularly concerned that House Bill 2153 creates a registry that has very specific requirements for inclusion on the registry, but without providing any capacity for the regulating department to police the activities of those who are on the list later on after they've joined the registry. The bill requires the department to engage in, quote, active oversight of the work and services of commercial interior designers. But as pointed out earlier, the bill does not appear to provide any resources or particular staff for the department to carry on those ongoing activities, and that's a concern for us. Specifically, our greatest concern is that the design services offered by our members, which, as I said, are not only residential but also for some small businesses, will suffer by comparison if their employees are not part of the registry, yet there's no guarantee in the bill because there's no policing of the quality of the services that are provided by those on the registry. So that's where we are at this point, and we would welcome further conversation about the bill.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm with the American Institute of Architects, and I'll be really brief. I just wanted to recognize on a slide that you received that talked about the difference with 2153 and what you might be hearing that isn't right, and I want to just clarify. It said 2153 does not require state oversight. It does require state oversight. It says what interior designers can and can't do. It says they cannot do building envelope. They cannot do structural or calculation required plans. It says they can't do it. So by virtue of saying what you can and can't do, someone has to do oversight to make sure you're following that law. Number two, it says it does not allow designers to supervise construction. Line 24 in the bill says that they're allowed to supervise the implementation of a plan. Number three, it says the 2153's purpose is to hold designers to the highest standards. You can't be held to a highest standard if there's no oversight. So it doesn't make sense. I want to be really clear in context. I feel like we agreed on a lot of things. Currently, under state statute, interior designers can, in fact, plan or do planning or remodeling and permit requiring for things over 4,000 square feet, as long as it doesn't change the occupancy or change any of the structural pieces inside the building. They're already allowed to do all that. So in this registry idea in the bill, it says they can't do certain things and they can do other things, but a lot of that's already allowed under the law unless it affects life, safety, welfare, and that's all we're looking out for. The clearest message I hope that you receive today is that we all think recognition of interior designers is a good idea. The three E's, education, experience, exam, important for the public to know, but is it important for the public to be protected from the work of an interior designer by giving them practice activities? We would say no.
Do we have any questions for this panel? Yes, we do, Representative.
I don't have a question for the panel, so I'm
just waving to me.
Yeah, well, hey,
I like to do that.
Maybe when we get to the point of what you mentioned a moment ago about what you wanted to discuss about going forward, that would probably be better. So I'll just
make sure
you know I want to talk about that.
Okay, great. Thanks. Well, thank you. It looks like you're free to sit in other chairs besides those. All right. Well, thank you. And I keep the hearing open until we have to. Okay. So I have heard a lot of good descriptions of why it would be useful to form a registry. I've heard some cautionary notes from people who seem in principle to support the idea of treating of interior design professionals being treated with dignity and professionalism and having robust economic opportunity. So it seems like there should be a way for us to move forward that's positive, that addresses some concerns raised from both perspectives. And this is a committee, which means it's sort of a team effort. And in the spirit of teamwork, which I think you folks have been engaging in today, and I think over the last several years as this legislative concept has ripened, there has been teamwork on. I'd like to ask the two co-vice chairs of the committee, Representative Marsh and Representative Brock Smith, we've got one Democrat, one Republican, two really good-hearted people who want to see economic opportunity created across the political spectrum and across the state, to take a lead on working with the proponents of the bill through your representatives and also people who've expressed concern to make some recommendations on how we could move forward. Now, that doesn't mean we have to end up in consensus, but I think that there's work for us to do to see if there are ways we can address concerns. And I've talked to these two before, so I'm confident they're not going to say, no, I won't do it, Chair Lining. that is my request for us to go forward. And so the people who have the kind of lead advocacy role for different perspectives, let's please have you coordinate. And Adam Crawford, our committee administrator, will also play some support role in that. And I'm hoping that in 2 weeks we can have some recommendations that would enable us to move the bill forward. Again, this is not a mandate to achieve consensus. It's a request to make some progress to address reasonable concerns on both sides. And then with that, did you have an emergency clause related comment?
No, there's no emergency clause. I don't think there was one. No.
No,
I think that will cover. And what I'll do is just send my notes over to the two here.
Please.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And I look forward to working with all of you. Maybe not all of you. I don't know the name. at least the various folks that testified on the opposition and of course, your group and the folks that you're working with on seeing what language we can get. I just want to know if Representative Marsh wanted to take the lead in the coordination with that as far as getting, you know, meeting time set up and the folks together.
Well, I'm also going to recognize Committee Administrator Adam Crawford, who...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Adam.
That is job.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the things I'd love to do, hopefully before everyone leaving, in order to deal with that organizational concept, just like with the committee, I will certainly support the work of this work group. So if it would be at all possible for those of you interested in involving yourselves in that work group to provide me with your contact information prior to you leaving today, so we can otherwise find a time that works best for both the representatives and start having these conversations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Rep. Marsh, did you want to make any comments?
I would just add, to emphasize what's already been stated, I think there is a great deal of agreement expressed in the room. I didn't hear anyone say we shouldn't have a registry. I think the challenge right now is that we are also trying to define scope of practice before we've really clarified what the requirements for the registry would be. And I think that there's some inherent conflicts in that. So some things that we need to sort through.
Good opportunities for progress. And Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to urge the work group, as we move along, to pick up on Representative Reschke's idea of of how we build the database and the registry, and to think about how we build that in a modern way as a transparent web-based database that is able to be easily accessed and kept up. Let's not go and do a registry like we used to do it in the 20th century. Let's do it the way we do it in the 21st century so we don't have to rebuild it in a few years. I thought it was a great point, and I hope that the work group will think about that.
Great, thanks. Any further thoughts? All right, well, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we'll also adjourn the meeting, and I'll invite the representatives of groups here to come forward so Adam can get your contact information. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Contact information. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Your